Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. It's the 28th of October, 2017. Today I'm going to do a short podcast on Wittgenstein. It's kind of Wittgenstein 101, if you like. And I intend to, in this podcast, just outline the Wittgensteinian terrain. My idea is that occasionally we can go a bit deeper into Wittgenstein's work, teasing out some interesting themes over time, with a view to ending up with quite a nice overview. And this is a bit of an ambitious idea, I have to say, because Wittgenstein's very difficult. One commentator on Wittgenstein, H.L. Finch, who's a commentator that I like his take on Wittgenstein, said that it took him ages just to even figure out what it was that Wittgenstein was talking about or worrying about. And the guy's a professional philosopher, and he even he had to kind of struggle to just get his bearings. Now, Wittgenstein's work's got two distinct phases. And we talk about the early and the later Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein actually only published one book in his life, and that was the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus. Posthumously, there was a work published called Philosophical Investigations. And that was pretty ready for publication at the time. So, really, two works, both great epoch-changing works, one published in Wittgenstein's lifetime and one after he died. You will find, if you look through a publisher's list, a number of other works, like Culture and Value and so on. And these were composed after Wittgenstein's death out of his notebooks. And there's some very interesting stuff in there as well. So, if we just deal with the phase one and the phase two, the early and the late Wittgensteins, and those two works in rough outline. Bear with me because it's a while since I've kind of actually dipped into the books themselves. But when you study them, they do kind of get ingrained. The work published in Wittgenstein's lifetime, the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, was composed by Wittgenstein during the First World War. And Wittgenstein fought for the Austro-Hungarian Soviet. He'd been in England prior to the war, first at Manchester studying aeronautical engineering, and then in Cambridge working on logic with Russell. Wittgenstein had come away from Cambridge without a degree, because basically he was batting problems in logic backwards and forwards with Russell. And he wrote a few papers, and in fact he asked that the university give him a bachelor's degree for the papers, and I think it was G.E. Moore was the guy with the power, said, well, no, it's against the rule. So Wittgenstein came away with no degree from Cambridge, having made an enormous contribution to philosophical logic already. So at the front, he's composing this very short book. And it's absolutely fascinating work. And Wittgenstein thought that this book had solved all the problems of philosophy. He actually said that, I've solved all the problems of philosophy. And I think he was convinced that he had in fact done that. the project of the Tractatus was to figure out what we can say. What can we actually say? What can we assert? And Wittgenstein started out with a presupposition, or maybe it's an axiom, right at the beginning, which says the world is everything that is the case. It's actually the position of logical atomism, which Russell and Wittgenstein had been playing with. The world is everything that is the case. So that the unit of existence isn't the atom or the molecule or the quark, but a state of affairs in the world, something that is the case. And the world is the sum total of all those facts. And so, yeah, it's called logical atomism. And one can look at the Tractatus as a working through of the ontology of logical atomism and teasing out its consequences. Now, I'm going to say that there are quite a few ways of looking at this whole Tractarian project. And there is a Wittgenstein industry of commentary and interpretation of both the former, the early and the late Wittgensteins. I mean, one would mention Hacker, H.L. Finch, who I said I like, Richard Rorty in Philosophy and the Mirror of Nature, tries to reckon with Wittgenstein. Gillian Anscombe, and so on. And there was a legacy of Wittgenstein disciples as well, who went on to influence modern philosophy, and they all had their own takes on various aspects of the work. But what I wanted to offer here is the Tractatus as a working through of the consequences of logical atomism. The argument actually gets quite technical. And Wittgenstein uses a logical calculus which proceeds through negation to come up with a taxonomy of things that we can assert. And it is technical, and you could spend the rest of your life poring over it. And if you have no acumen for that kind of stuff, maybe you pass over it and just take it for read. There's a technical argument that results here. But it's the results that are interesting. Wittgenstein comes up with this, that the propositions of science can be true or false. The propositions of logic and mathematics are tautologies. In other words, they have the character of an equation like naught equals naught. They just basically say the same thing on both sides of the equation. And that the propositions of ethics and aesthetics are nonsense. Wittgenstein then does the amazing thing and if you've been listening to podcasts on Lao Tzu, you'll hear a resonance here. And the amazing thing that Wittgenstein does is to turn around and say the propositions of this work, the propositions of the Tractatus, are themselves nonsense, but useful nonsense. And then Wittgenstein uses a metaphor to make his point, or to reinforce his point. And he says, regard the work, the Tractatus, as a ladder with which one climbs up onto the roof. The important point about being on the roof is to look at the view. and you can push the ladder away. And that is the ladder is the tractatus, and this was his metaphor for trying to explain what he'd done. And then right at the end, Wittgenstein says, "Whereof one cannot speak, one should remain silent." So in a sense, one should remain silent on the matters of aesthetics and ethics. This is a bit bleak. If all we can do with reason understood as being in good proportion a matter of the application of logic, then we've got no purchase on all the ethical dilemmas and all the aesthetic preferences and all the things that matter for us working out what the good life is. Now, after the war, Wittgenstein went back to Cambridge to teach at some point. And actually, Russell wrote a foreword, or a preface, to the Tractatus, in which it's clear that he didn't really understand it. And nevertheless, Wittgenstein was actually awarded a PhD. He submitted the Tractatus as a PhD thesis at Cambridge. And he was examined by G.E. Moore, who'd kind of blocked his path prior to the war, and Russell himself. And I think in the report, G.E. Moore wrote, "Mr. Wittgenstein is a genius. Whatever the value of his work, it easily falls within the standards of Doctor of Philosophy at the University of Cambridge." Just, I'm paraphrasing, but it's kind of quite close. And Wittgenstein, apparently on his way out from the Viva, clapped the two of them on the shoulder and says, "Don't worry, you'll never understand it." And it's something that the Tractatus, it's fascinating, and you can be quite struck by it, because it's just numbered aphorisms, 1.1, 1.2. And Wittgenstein shows you the structure of his argument with the way he numbers the aphorisms. So you've got aphorism 1. And then 1.2. But if there's something tangential to 1.2, it might be 1.21. So that there's this numbering system whereby the stuff after the decimal point enables you to locate each particular proposition or each particular element in the argument in the overall structure of the thing. And it's very useful for following the path of Wittgenstein's thought. I mean, it did cause a revolution. It gave rise to the Vienna Circle, and they elaborated out of the Tractatus verificationism. They'd say, you know, we should only entertain a proposition as having any meaning if it could be verified, if we could state the conditions under which it would be verified. And this become the kind of logical positivism, and feeding off into some kind of scientism. I mean, later, Karl Popper, who had been a member of that group, wanted to cast doubt on this idea, and he came up with the falsification hypothesis. And which characterises scientific method as hypothetico-deductive, which means that you have to have an hypothesis which you then attempt to falsify in order to get at scientific laws or to discern regularities in the course of events in the universe, enabling predictability. Anyway, that's a bit of an aside, but an interesting one, I have to say. Now, Wittgenstein actually changed his mind about what he'd achieved with the Tractatus. he believed that he had no longer solved all the problems of philosophy. And one suspects that he was quite pained by how the Tractatus had left us without moorings for our ethical and aesthetic considerations, which at the same time we couldn't do without. But it was on the terrain of language, of thinking about language, of thinking about what can we say. It gradually dawned on Wittgenstein what the error was in the Tractatus. And it's this. The Tractatus supposes, well, not only logical atomism, but it supposes that we only do one thing with language, which is to state facts. Or, if you want to be a bit more ornate about this, give a propositional depiction of the world. This means that language, all that language does is state things that can be either true or false, that can be either asserted or denied. And, of course, you can see how the logical positives picked up on this, because anything that fell outside of that was meaningless. So, actually, that means most of the stuff that we talk about is meaningless on that picture of the world. And Wittgenstein turned around and said, actually, no, I was wrong about that. Propositional depiction of the world is very important. You certainly wouldn't want to be without it if you were accused of something in a law court and the witnesses weren't trusted because what they were saying was nonsense, you know, or just not counted. And, of course, there have been cultural circumstances where conditions like that have obtained, you know, we can recall times not that long ago when the guilt or innocence was determined by whether or not they survived being ducked underwater. If they died, they were innocent. If they floated and survived, they were guilty and had to be killed anyway. Well, that's great stuff, you know, and the propositional depiction of the world enables us to have forensics and so forth all depend on this. It's very important, but it's not everything. And this is what gave rise to the philosophical investigations. And right at the beginning of philosophical investigations, Wittgenstein tells a story of some blokes, some builders passing slabs to each other. And the way that they use language to perform these tasks. And the upshot is that Wittgenstein says, well, not only do we use language for fact stating, we use language for praying, for ordering, for poeticising, for expressing grief and love and so forth. And the way we use language is actually organised into language games, which are embedded in actual social practices, in actual customs, and not really that separate from them. So we have the language game of praying, and it's surrounded with a whole lot of rules. You know, you stand up when the vicar stands up, you kneel when the vicar says kneel, etc. And a language game is embedded completely in our social existence and the things that we do. And then there's quite a lot of detail about all that. And of course, this liberated Wittgenstein to think about ethics, to think about culture, to think about aesthetics, to think about psychology, and comment on anthropology and all kinds of things. It liberated him because he realised that if he could identify the language games and so forth, he could actually gain a purchase on a lot of conundrums. And the philosophical investigations and the stuff from the later notebooks is full of fascinating material like this. Wittgenstein said that what he was doing was clearing away the rubble and figuring out how, in particular instances, our intelligence was bewitched by language, by means of an analysis of the language, by means of a looking at what's going on. Wittgenstein also characterised what he did was helping the fly to escape from the fly bottle. He had this idea of philosophical therapy, that we could be released into a state of peace when our puzzlement, which was a bewitchment by language, was exposed through a certain kind of looking at how the language is being used. And he called that, a kind of philosophical therapy and helping the fly to escape from the fly bottle. In a sense, he was trying to destroy philosophy. Hilary Putnam, an American mathematician turned philosopher, said of Wittgenstein that he had made a bonfire of our philosophical vanities, and it's a good description. So, that was right off the top of my head, so I hope it's fairly lucid. And I do recommend getting some kind of a grip on Wittgenstein's work. It's amazing, I would say. And there is a possibility of the fly escaping from the fly bottle. Somewhere else Wittgenstein said that what he'd aimed to achieve for himself was to be able to stop philosophising when he wanted to. I mean, he did work on philosophical problems most of his life, apart from a period after the Tractatus when he thought, well, I've done it. Then he went and became a schoolmaster in a junior school in Austria. He thought he'd done it. And then these perplexities were arising about the use of language. And he was back into it. He was back at Cambridge. And yes, but he thought it was important for him and somebody like him to be able to see where the conundrums had come from, rather than perhaps solving them. He talked about dissolving problems rather than solving them by exposing the way language had structured the problem in the first place. And I recommend that to people who are compelled to think. And some of us do have a will to truth, however much yoga we practice. In fact, practicing yoga, I think, intensifies that will to truth. But it also, if you listen to Wittgenstein and you listen to Patanjali, it also shows you how you can take some rest from it, how you can have some peace. And let the mind settle. So, I hope it's useful, I hope it's enjoyable, and thank you for listening.